I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is writer and novelist Emma Klein. She's joined in conversation by writer and editor Ellen Sussman. And now join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Emma Klein. Emma Klein's The Girls is one of those rare debut novels that becomes a literary sensation. It's loosely based on the Manson murders, but the novel focuses more on the women around Charles Manson who are attracted to life at the edge of the world. The Girls is the coming-of-age story of 14-year-old Evie Boyd, a bored, upper-middle-class, only child of divorce, drawn to Manson's free-spirited, rebellious clan. Klein sets the story in her native Sonoma County, where she grew up one of seven kids, and incidentally, several of her siblings are here tonight. The raves have come pouring in from the New York Times, calling the book spellbinding, and from one of our most famous girls, Lena Dunham, who says, "This book will break your heart and blow your mind." Appearing in conversation with Emma Klein tonight is another local literary luminate, Ellen Sussman, whose most recent novel is A Wedding in Provence. Please welcome them both, Ellen Sussman and Emma Klein, to the JCCSF.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you all for being here. I'm just thrilled tonight to be able to talk to Emma. I read her book when it first came out, so when Barbara called and asked if I wanted to do this interview, there was no hesitation. It's definitely, so far, my favorite book of this year.
So far.
And I have so many questions for her. So I am assuming many of you have already read the book, but if you have, you will get a chance to be reminded of Emma's luscious prose. And for those of you who have not yet heard this, you're in for a real treat. So she's going to start by reading a couple of pages.
So this is just from the very beginning of the book. It's the first two pages. Okay. I looked up because of the laughter and kept looking because of the girls. I noticed their hair first, long and uncombed, then their jewelry catching the sun. The three of them were far enough away that I saw only the periphery of their features, but it didn't matter. I knew they were different from everyone else in the park. Families milling in a vague line, waiting for sausages and burgers from the open grill. Women in checked blouses, scooting into their boyfriends' sides. Kids tossing eucalyptus buttons at the feral-looking chickens that overran the strip. These long-haired girls seemed to glide above all that was happening around them, tragic and separate, like royalty in exile. I studied the girls with a shameless, blatant gape. It didn't seem possible that they might look over and notice me. My hamburger was forgotten in my lap, the breeze blowing in minnow stink from the river. It was an age when I'd immediately scan and rank other girls, keeping up a constant tally of how I fell short, and I saw right away that the black-haired one was the prettiest. I had expected this, even before I'd been able to make out their faces. There was a suggestion of otherworldliness hovering around her, a dirty smock dress barely covering her ass. She was flanked by a skinny redhead and an older girl, dressed with the same shabby afterthought, as if dredged from a lake, all their cheap rings like a second set of knuckles. They were messing with an uneasy threshold, prettiness and ugliness at the same time, and a ripple of awareness followed them through the park. Mothers glancing around for their children, moved by some feeling they couldn't name. Women reaching for their boyfriends' hands. The sun spiked through the trees like always, the drowsy willows, the hot wind gusting over the picnic blankets. But the familiarity of the day was disturbed by the path the girls cut across the regular world, sleek and thoughtless as sharks breaching the water.
Wow. It's wonderful to come back to those couple of pages after having read the book, because it's packed. Everything that the book is about is already hidden in those two pages. It's really wonderful. So I wanted to start, I guess, at the beginning, and that would be how you got to this. When I was 21, I was absolutely sure that I would have my first novel published in my 20s, and you're 27, right? And it didn't happen. It didn't happen, in fact, till I was 49. So over the years, I have convinced myself pretty well that the reason it didn't happen is because we need to grow up, we need to get wise, we need to have life experience. You could have all kinds of writing chops, but that doesn't make you a writer if you're too young. So how the hell do you... This book is so wise. It is so full of the kinds of observations and understandings, especially of young girls and of life, that I find very surprising for a 27-year-old. And the writing is, there's no question about the real chops that you have. So did you come fully formed into this? Did you always want to be a writer? How did you get here?
Yeah, I think I always wanted to be a writer. I'm from a very big family. As Barbara said, I'm one of seven children. So as a young kid, reading was a way to have a private space. You didn't have to share with six other people. You could have your own world. So yeah, just naturally out of that, I always wanted to be a writer.
And did you study writing through college and grad school?
Yeah, I was actually an art major in college, studio art, and I went to San Francisco Art Institute for a little while. But yeah, I took a few writing classes, but I always thought it would be more interesting to study something else, just to have that sort of sideways viewpoint on art and writing.
And you still do you make art?
I do, not as much. I don't do much of anything these days except talk
except for
about
go
the book.
On tour.
But yeah, I think it was helpful because it's so many of the same aims. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, how do you make this private world visible to other people?
Mm-hmm. In fact, that's one of the things that I find so remarkable about your prose. You get exactly the right revealing detail that helps us see the world the way your character sees the world.
Yeah, I was Joan Didion, I feel, is such a good California writer who's so good at picking that one illuminating detail, right. You know, and it's right. Slightly adjacent to what you'd expect.
Mm. And what are other influences over the years?
Yeah, I mean, she, for sure, I think it was the first time I understood you could write about California and the mythology of California, and you could do it through a very personal lens. You know, mm-hmm. She's writing about huge cultural moments, right. but really choosing these small frames to look at them through. And then Mary Gateskill is another writer who I just think is so good at talking about having a female body and friendship and love and sex in a way that's really unexpected and fresh to me.
Mm, wonderful. Love both those examples. So where did the inspiration come for this book? And I'm curious about the research. Did you spend a ton of time doing research and then create your own story? This is not Manson's story. It's also a wonderful choice to tell the story of the girls and not the leader of this group or commune. So I'm curious what led you to this material and how you made some of those choices.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a time period that I was very aware of growing up, especially in Northern California, as we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. It's a place that's still so haunted by the 60s in a way. So it was really the legacy I was dealing with growing up. And then, you know, so I read all about the Manson family, but also Jonestown, mm-hmm. another Northern California export. Right. Great job, Northern California. But, you know, I read so much about them in high school, and maybe that was around the age when I first realized that there were these young girls involved often. And I was thinking about who are the people around the perimeters of these groups, mm-hmm. And sort of what's the story they tell themselves now about what that meant. And just thinking what's universal there about the way we think about our past, the way we feel that life, you know, rides on these choices, or is it luck? You know, how does life turn out and why?
Mm,
and then also wanting to write about teenage girls in a way that wasn't overly simplified and that didn't turn them into objects or, you know, representative of some moral position.
Right. In fact, it's Evie. Do you pronounce it Evie?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Evie, who is the center of the story and is 14 years old, she is the perfect entree for this world because she is so vulnerable. She is so adrift. Talk a little bit about the choice of her as the person who should tell this story.
Yeah, I thought a lot about what age to make her. And to me, 14 is such a particular moment when you're really coming up against the adult world. And especially for a young girl, I think it's that moment when you're first encountering, you know, your life as a sexual being and how does the world treat young women in that realm, which can be very dispiriting. And then, I wanted her to be very vulnerable in ordinary ways also. She's not more vulnerable than any, you know, ordinary girl. And that's something I was thinking about. I think we have this tendency, especially when you're thinking about something so extreme as this infamous crime, that the people involved must be marked in some way, or that there must have been some sign early on that they were, you know, meant for this outcome. So I really wanted a character who, in many ways, is...
Could be any of us.
It's right? Very ordinary.
Yeah, no, in fact, I think that's what... seems so striking at first is her life could be our lives, and we can't remove ourselves from the journey that she takes, even as dark as it gets. We're right there kind of in her shadow.
Right. Yeah, and it's a much different project, I think, than trying to tell the book from the point of view of somebody who was really involved in the crimes or someone at the heart of the group. And I think that's become almost a cliche at this point, like the charismatic male leader. I feel like that's normally where a story like this would be centered.
Right.
And for me, I'm really tired of that trope at this point, and really wanted to make that character, Russell, a really secondary character. Only once, and it was a man, they were like, love the book, why not more about Russell? He's the interesting one. And I was like, oh, if only the title of the book had indicated that maybe it would not be about him.
It's also so funny. I got a post on Facebook today when I had posted that I was doing this. Somebody wrote, well, I love that book, but why didn't she tell the story about the trial? It's not Charles Manson.
Right.
And it is not his story. It
is
so much, not just Evie's story, but the story of the girls.
Right.
So I'd love for you to talk about, you know, we hear a lot these days about the male gaze. But let's talk about the female gaze. And you start there in those first two pages.
And that's what I was really interested in, is this act of looking, which I think really unifies the book in a way. It's so much about being seen and that desire to be seen, which kind of never leaves Evie, even in later life. I was thinking about what would the male gaze look like internalized. I feel Evie is a narrator who's really internalized that male gaze and almost sees the women around her like a man would. She's so used to this really surface-level, hierarchical judgment. So in a way, she's a very harsh narrator.
Right.
And that's partly why I wanted there to be this older version of her that's actually narrating the story. Mm-hmm. Because I feel to be in a teenager's brain for an entire novel is slightly oppressive. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. I reread my high school diaries before I read
in preparation for writing.
That's great. And you know,
how
you
painful
always
was
think,
that
you'll be like, oh, I was a really thoughtful teenager, I was really smart, and then you read this diary and it's just an embarrassment. I was a monster, really monstrous. And so I think, you know, every feeling a teenager has is so extreme, and there's like a real purity in that. how deeply they feel things and how idealistic almost they are about the world. Right. I think compromise for them is really an anathema. Right. And I think that's why adults can be so disappointing, because you see, you know, they're compromising. Why aren't they, you know, sticking to these ideals? Mm-hmm. You know, teenagers are all about black and white feelings, and the adult world is very much about gray areas. So that's why I liked having an older narrator who could contextualize those immense feelings.
Well, I want to get back to the friendship question in a second, but bringing up the adult narrator, I loved that choice. Did you know that right away, that you would start, that she would be a major presence?
Yeah, that was actually my only entryway wow. into the book. I never was going to be a book just told from the point of view of a 14-year-old or this one summer. I think for me what was really interesting, and I think it came out of growing up in California at this time period when it is still dealing with this immense nostalgia for the 60s and like also trying to grapple with what it meant, is someone in the present day looking back and trying to make sense of it. And then also I really was interested in Evie, the elder Evie, as somebody who's in this very morally ambiguous position. Right. And sort of what are the ways this one summer has haunted her life.
And with the young woman who was there in the
right.
house with her.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think we have this narrative that you go through something difficult or traumatic and you emerge on the other side as a stronger person, having learned a lesson. And I really wanted to write a character who didn't learn anything.
Right.
Sorry, spoiler alert. Like, there's really no moral. Like,
right.
And for me, that was, it's an interesting challenge I set for myself, is how do you write a book that responds to how life feels often? Because I don't feel that life necessarily has that clear of a narrative or right. these clear morals and lessons.
So it's not a redemptive story
right.
in
yeah.
the end.
And yeah, in many ways, she's stuck in this summer.
Right. In fact, one of the things that I like so much about the adult Evie looking back and in the current situation with the young couple in the house is that we get a chance to see how was she affected by what happened? Who is she now? And the expectation is, as you say, that she will be
right.
much improved and a fully formed, you know, person in the world, and she is still adrift.
Right.
She's not quite found her way. So there's something so authentic about that to me. I don't feel like I'm being manipulated by a writer, which we so often feel. It feels much truer to the story that you're telling.
Yeah. I like the ending to be ambiguous in the same way, too, that there's no neat bow tied
right.
around anything.
Right. In fact, speaking of the ending, at the very beginning of the novel, after that scene, and at the very end of the novel, there is a hint of danger from a man. So I'm assuming conscious choice on your part. Did that come right away? Did you find your way?
Yeah, I always knew how I wanted the story to open. With these strangers in the house who turn out to be benign, but that first immediate feeling of
yeah.
fear and horror, which I right. think for me is what was maybe the fizziest thing about the reading about the Manson murders when I was young, is the sense that your home wasn't safe.
Right.
And that's the way my parents talked about it. Both of them grew up in California. And they really talk about it as this moment when suddenly people started locking their doors.
And it's also that Evie is not safe,
right.
even years later.
Yeah.
And part of what makes her not safe is that she knows how close she came to, I don't want to give things away, but to be
right.
a part of that.
Yeah.
Right?
I think for her there's something really scary. And what I was thinking about in writing the book is that it's so much more comforting to believe that the people who perpetrate these kinds of murders or crimes, that they're monsters who are much different
right.
than us.
Right.
And to me, what's actually a lot more frightening is that they're people who are familiar
right.
to us and that are recognizably human and vulnerable.
Right.
You're listening to writer Emma Klein, whose debut novel is The Girls. She's joined in conversation by writer and editor Ellen Sussman on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So that brings me back to the question of the female friendships. Evie makes her way into, finds these girls, becomes a part of the group, attaches herself in particular to one of the girls, and they are not evil. In some ways, in fact, they're protective at the same time as terribly dangerous.
Right.
Talk a little bit about those choices.
Yeah, I mean, I really like the idea of writing a book, especially a coming-of-age story, that focuses on this other kind of love story.
Right.
I think traditionally it's, you know,
no.
a very, you know, normalized love story. And I think that dynamic between an older girl and a younger girl is so particularly interesting to me, too,
right.
because of the way it involves idol worship and there's competition, but also real love.
Right. And a desire to be seen and
right.
protected.
And I think in many ways, this relationship for Evie is the closest she ever gets to being truly seen, which I think is partly why later as an adult, she can't move beyond
right.
it.
Right.
It's kind of in many ways. What if this summer, when you were involved with this infamous, you know, crime, what if that was the best summer of your life?
Right.
Like, how do you make sense of that
right.
later?
That is, it is definitely what I was thinking while I was reading those sections, and it's very unsettling, as it must be to her.
Yeah.
Yeah, you seem to have really crawled into her skin and have gotten there in a very deep way.
Yeah, I think I was also thinking about you know, like the Manson family or Jonestown, even all these people who circled around those groups but weren't involved in the major famous crime or whatever, or sort of what happens to them later. And just from being interested in this stuff in high school, you see them popping up on message boards. The internet is great for novelists and freaks everywhere. But it still seems really important to them, and obviously it was this moment they're still struggling to make sense of, but also at the same time wanting to identify themselves with.
Right.
And that's really interesting to me, is like, what's behind that desire to be known and to be seen still?
Yeah. We were talking a little bit before we came out. I moved up to Sebastopol about a year and a half ago, and from Silicon Valley, so it's a completely different world, as many of you probably know. And in Sebastopol, it's as if the 60s are still going on. there is not a great distance between then and now. And while I was reading the novel, I was aware that there were not a ton of references, cultural references, the music that they were listening to, the books that they were reading, what
yeah.
was on TV. Did you do that purposely?
I did. Yeah, I think the 60s is such a tricky time to write about because it's so familiar still in our consciousness. I think there's
right.
such mythic visual tropes that came out of the 60s,
mm-hmm.
and we all have these immediate images that pop up in our minds when we think of the 60s. And I really wanted to avoid that and to, in many ways, you know, write a novel that maybe felt a little more universal, even though it's pinned down to this one year. And part of it was just thinking about how do you represent a 14-year-old's experience in 1969? What is she thinking about? And thinking about how do people experience their cultural moment? And my mom also kept a diary when she was 13 and 14, so around 1969.
Did she let you read it?
She did. And the day that man landed on the moon, all she wrote in her diary was, "Got a terrible haircut today." And it was so wonderful, and I really thought back to that entry so much in writing this book, because that's not how a 14-year-old girl is experiencing them. She's not, you know, thinking about the political movements. It's really, who are the people who are important to you? What's
yeah.
the immediate emotional drama of your life?
It's great. It is. It truly does not feel that we are stuck in time. It feels like you're writing about now as well as then, and I so admire that.
Oh,
it's
good.
Not an it's really not very easy to do that, especially when it's specifically tied to a crime that we all
right.
know about at a time. That's great. Your prose is, as I said before, I love the sort of exquisite details, the surprise of the details, that what we see is kind of always a little bit askew, and what we learn from that. I'd love to hear a little bit about your process. Is that what comes out in the first draft? Please don't say yes. How do you get there? And then do you have readers who help you? Do you go through many drafts?
Yeah, I do go through. This book was maybe 2 or 3 years of working on it in various drafts. And what's so weird, and maybe this is your experience writing novels too, but like it's such a mess until the last week when it's not a mess.
Yeah.
It's really trying to remember how it became not a mess is so, you know, complicated when it's over. But yeah, many drafts. One of my sisters who's here tonight, she's usually my first reader. I feel like sisters you can really abuse as readers. You can make them read so many more drafts than a normal person would. but yeah, for me, it's a lot about finding an image with some torque or... yeah, fizz.
So language in the very first draft, well, you'll go for those images right away.
Yeah, and for me, the trickiest part is how do you link that back to a story with some forward momentum?
And how much of the story do you know in advance?
Yeah, with this, it really was not known. And then maybe the last summer I was working on it, the last 3 months, that's when I really settled down with an outline. And that really helped bring it together.
So you had already written a draft.
Yeah.
And then had to shape it in a different way. Interesting. And then what was the process like with your editor at Random House?
Yeah, we were talking earlier. My editor is a really old school New York editor. She's the only person I've seen wearing a Chanel suit in real life. It was a shock. she writes very formal editorial letters. So they're many pages long and they sort of arrive at my apartment in Brooklyn. She had also never been to Brooklyn. So she came to visit
Manhattan.
Me one time. She's lived there her whole life. And I could tell she put on her Brooklyn pantsuit. She was in pants, so that's how I could tell. She knew she was headed to Brooklyn that day. But yeah, she was wonderful. And yeah, we were saying earlier, you're so grateful for an editor.
Yeah.
It's like you don't have to do it alone.
Right.
I think that's
right.
Why so many writers want to do TV and movies, because you're like, oh, you get to do it with a whole room full of people? Sign me up.
I agree with you, but there are writers who don't want to be edited to anthologies, and there are writers who don't want their prose to be touched. And
yeah.
So I'm glad you see it that
way. Oh, yeah,
too.
I'm grateful for it.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about we talk about the female gaze, the male gaze. You've got the world gaze right now. Emma just came back from a 3-week European tour. The book has been so successful and so received so much attention. What does that feel like? And can you write? Does that feed your confidence and your sense of excitement about moving forward? Is it intimidating?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very alienating in a way to go from this deeply private experience where you have no sense of the life of the book beyond finishing it. It's to this very public moment where you're putting something out in the world and kind of having to deal with that part of it. And I think for me, it's really about reminding myself why I write, and it's not for those reasons, not for the public reasons, not for the noise. That part feels very unnatural to me.
Right.
And I think remembering that I would have written this book even if no one wanted to read it.
Right.
But it is funny, having written a book so much about how we objectify women, and then to go through the publishing process as a young woman.
Right.
You're just like, did you know? You didn't read the book.
Well, that's fine. In fact, I noticed in some of the interviews a little too much attention on your hair
right,
or the color
yeah.
of your eyes. And I'm not quite sure that a man would be getting that kind of attention.
Or like, what kind of clothes do you like to wear? You're human's clothes?
Right.
Pants?
And are you working on the next novel?
I am, yeah. Good. What's weird about writing a book, as you know too, is like you finish it and then there's a year of strange limbo where you're like both anxious and then also wanting to work on something new.
And the best thing in the world that you could do is to work on something new.
Yeah, which is nice, I think, because that makes all this noise feel like noise, like it's not important. What's important is writing and getting back to that.
Good. So I'm assuming you won't talk about that yet.
No, yeah, it's still early days, but good. It feels nice. And there's like one, if there's one good thing about doing the publicity stuff or the interviews, it's like, wow, writing is better than that, at least. So it makes you want to write. Nothing else really does. And it's kind of like the antidote is the poison. You know, you're like, oh, no.
Do you have a writing schedule? Are you a very disciplined
writer?
No,
I'm not. And I'm always so jealous when people are like, oh, I'm up with the sun. Like, I've donned my writing cloak. Like, I light 8 black candles. And you're like, no, I have no schedule. But I'd like one. Do you have one? Can I steal it? Yeah.
So it's just really when you feel the urge.
And I think it's busy this summer. The last couple of months have been book-focused.
Yeah,
but it is weird because it's, you know, you finished this a while ago. It's like your kid's home from boarding school. You're like, you again? And then, you know, you reacquaint yourself.
I remember going on a book tour and forgetting the names of my characters.
Oh, God, yeah. Someone said, tell me about this character. And I was like,
who is it?
What? Yeah, I had no recollection. I was like, anyway, the cover is really great, right?
I do love the cover. So I also had read that Scott Rudin bought the movie rights. Will you be involved? Are you?
No.
No?
Yeah,
you,
I think.
Are you choosing not to be involved?
Yeah, they asked if I wanted to write the script. And for me, yeah, I've spent a lot of time with these characters in the story, and I feel really invested in a new project.
Good.
And yeah.
Good.
And I think it's easy to get stuck in like the quicksand of TV people.
And is it happening? Do you know? Or?
I don't know. Yeah, I try to keep as little. I want to know as little as possible.
Great. One of the the questions that I had in the book that I found haunted me was that how close Evie came to the darkest side of herself. Did you know as you were writing how far she would go?
Yeah, I mean, I think I always knew that I wanted that morally ambiguous position, and I didn't want her to be fully involved, because that's a different story. Uh-huh. And I mean, an interesting one, but not my project.
Did you know whether she would make the choice herself?
I always knew that I kind of wanted someone else to make it, because I think in a way that's almost the worst, because you don't get that certainty.
Right.
There's not that sense of, oh, I know myself. It's like, oh, my life really rests on this moment of luck.
Right.
And
which may have a lot to do with why she is adrift at the end of the night, later on in her life.
And in a way, even jealous of Suzanne or the others, who get this very clear verdict and this very clear narrative and the chance for redemption then, because they've been announced as guilty.
Was there any pressure from your publisher to give clearer answers, happy endings?
Yeah, I think a few times they were like, there's a few too many pimples and scabs in this book. Which, fair enough, but that was really the only thing they were trying to, you know, cheer up a little, maybe.
So
but
they weren't concerned about the ambiguous.
No, I think they understood that that was my main, the thing I was most interested in circling around as a writer.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and I think I love that position of an outsider to the observer. That, for me, has always been such an interesting, I feel like The Great Gatsby is a good example of another, like, spooky observer.
Right, Nick.
And sort of in which ways are observers culpable.
Terrific. That's great. I read in one of the articles about you or interviews that because you grew up in such a large family, you always felt sort of an affinity to communal life.
Yeah. I mean, I think a commune is an exaggerated version of a family, always. So in writing about a commune, you're just writing about a family, but just more amplified.
Right.
But definitely, one of 7 kids, as the other 4 in the audience can tell you. It's like, it's so complicated, and there's so much jostling and power dynamics. It's really something, I think that's why I'm interested in writing about group dynamics.
And so you take the Evie, who's about the loneliest girl imaginable, and throw her in to that chaos that's much more familiar to you, too.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, less murder in my family than this one, but so far.
That's great. I think I will open it up now to questions from the audience.
I'm curious about a character whose name I don't remember, and hopefully you'll remember.
She doesn't either.
But it's the young college student from UC Berkeley who, I guess, she gets a ride from Berkeley up back up to the commune, and who's the engineering student and kind of square and is a sort of the voice of morality. And he comes across as using, you know, fuzzy words like nice, but I thought they were pretty powerful moments when he says, look around you, this place is a mess.
Yeah.
I mean, where did that come from? I was just curious about that.
Yeah. I think it's like you said, it's a place for almost the reader to intervene. The reader sees what's happening, but Evie doesn't, and no one else in the book really does. And so by having an outsider enter, you get to sort of illuminate the reality of the situation instead of this fantasy. Tom, I remember his name. Gold Star.
And it happens at just the right moment, because we as the reader are not quite sure how bad is it.
Yeah.
And then when we hear it at that point from his point of view, we're ready for that other voice of reason.
Yeah, it's a reality check.
Yeah.
So this might be kind of annoying, but what drives you to write? Like, what motivates you? It's not fame, it's not money. So what kind of, you know, you said you knew you wanted to be a writer at a really young age.
Yeah.
So what was it?
Yeah. That's another thing where it's like, I wish I had a really inspiring answer, but it's almost like a compulsion. Or it's like, it's the only thing I'm good at. I wish there were other things, but it's like a one-trick pony. I don't know. I mean, I think what I've enjoyed about writing and what's brought me back to it is this sense that you can kind of gather the moments of your life in some way and create some kind of meaning out of them, or that you can think about these questions maybe without ever coming to a satisfactory answer. But that you get to think about almost the minutia of life in a way that otherwise would pass you by. Why do you write?
Well, I was just trying to remember whether it's a Joan Didion quote about we write to find out what we think, what we know. Is it a Joan Didion quote?
Yes, Joan.
Yeah. And that's what I'm hearing in your answer, and I think that is very true, that life is messy and confusing and chaotic, and we can sit down in our own little bubbles and create these stories that help us find a path through all of it, make sense of it. And I don't think we necessarily come to writing with answers.
Right, exactly.
We come to it with lots of questions, and that's what I see you doing in that book.
Yeah, I feel like those are the books I'm drawn to as a reader, too, books that kind of ask questions that don't offer any kind of answer.
Right, that's great.
Hi. I loved the book. In fact, we were such nerds this summer. We read it together on the beach. We each had a copy because we didn't want to give it up. But we spend a lot of time up in Petaluma. We own a pet shop up there and live out in Tomales. And I loved, you know, reading all about the town and really picturing it. And I thought it was really interesting that the beach town, which I'm guessing is Dillon Beach, but I don't know. I was curious why you never mentioned the name of it or really placed where that was, as opposed to really placing it in Petaluma and even the names of the roads that you had.
Yeah, I don't know why. I mean, I was thinking of Dillon Beach for sure. Yeah. Good job. But yeah, it wasn't a purposeful thing. It might have even been that I don't like Dillon Beach as a name, just the way it sounds. But Petaluma, I like. But yeah, I really like this, you know, because California, there's this image of it as this really sunny, you know, paradise. And I think Northern California, beach towns especially, have that real darkness. Like, they're so beautiful, but there's a real darkness there. You know, like the water is frigid and there are actual sharks swimming around in them and people get bit all the time. You're just like, oh my God.
And it's so damn cold.
Yes. So I loved it as like this counterpoint to this hot, you know, sunny summer is this beach town where where it's foggy and gray. Mm-hmm.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Emma Klein, whose debut novel is The Girls. She's joined in conversation by writer and editor Ellen Sussman. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Hi, so I'm a Middlebury grad as well, and I'm 27 and not nearly as accomplished as you, but I had a question just because I'm an editor, writer as well, and I wondered how much research went into this. Did you know you wanted to write about this subject in high school when it piqued your interest, or did you hatch upon the idea later in life? How did you come to it?
Yeah, I was writing about groups in high school, too, but I wasn't thinking about this moment. But I think I always knew I wanted to write about California, especially. Sort of these extreme heightened situations, which for me, a commune is kind of a heightened situation. And the 60s feels like an extreme moment. And then I think I always knew I wanted to write about girls, especially in girlhood. Like I was saying before, especially as someone who was a young girl, you read so many versions of girlhood or what it's supposed to look like, and it can feel very alienating and untrue. And just wanting to write about it in a way that allowed for kind of complex humanity, mm-hmm. and girls who weren't just good girls or bad girls or sort of flat characters, and that were allowed to be ambivalent and nasty
and complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah. And did you know right away, once you sort of zeroed in on Charles Manson's story, did you know right away that you didn't want to use L.A. but would choose...
Yeah, I think Northern California is so interesting to me. I love it here.
Yeah.
I really love it. I'm in New York now, but I really want to move home.
Spent backstage trying to talk her into moving back.
Because I think it's just such a particular ecosystem, and there are so many types of people here. And there's something about the landscape to me that really produces like an interesting character type, even. And L.A. doesn't interest me in the same way. I don't know it. I don't care about it. For the reason, sorry. but yeah, and setting it in Northern California was just a way to sort of claim ownership over the story without feeling any responsibility to the facts or the people who really get into the details of it.
And did you feel a need to move away from the Charles Manson story to make it your own and not a...
I think because it's such a familiar story.
Right.
Not even in the U.S., like I was on this European tour, and everyone there knows Manson. The worst question I got in Germany, they were like, who's worse, Charles Manson or Hitler? And I was like, I don't want to answer this question. Trump, ha, ha. But yeah, I mean, I think when you're going to, you know, it's like looking straight into the sun, like, writing about Charles Manson. Like, we all know that story. There's nothing fresh there or new. And what I think I was interested in the story are, like, almost more archetypal things about it or symbolic things, like the mood and the atmosphere.
Right.
And so how can you write about it without, you know, feeling a responsibility to it? It's only by renaming it and sort of reshaping it.
And giving yourself that creative license to create something.
Right, yeah. Otherwise, it's so oppressive.
Right, right. So smart.
Hi. As Ellen intimated, I think there's really impressive interpersonal wisdom in terms of sort of getting into the heads of the different characters and their motivations and their insights or lack of insights. And so I'm just curious if particularly given your age, you know, so many people will look back at their teens or their 20s and think, like, what was I thinking? You know, I was so clueless. And so I'm just curious, like, were you known among your friends and family all along for being like that? Do you think it came from being from a large family? Or
I think we should let her siblings answer that question.
I feel like being, you know, writing about interpersonal things as a writer does not translate to, like, great interpersonal skills as just a human in the world, unfortunately. Because I think it's much easier to see characters as characters. And I think their motivations are much clearer to you. Whereas in life, I feel you're almost always a mystery to yourself. But that was really what interested me in writing the book is almost, instead of focusing on this one moment of a very obvious lurid violence, is thinking about almost the psychological violence and in everyday ways, sort of how our family relationships and romantic relationships and friendships sort of haunted by these violent acts in much smaller versions.
We even look at how her relationship with her father, and it's a perfectly, I can't say normal relationship, but it does not seem dangerous. And then suddenly it seems dangerous.
Yeah.
So you've shifted the balance so that every interpersonal relationship has the capacity to turn in that way.
Right, yeah. I think I was thinking a lot about, you know, the surface of things, especially things we think of as safe, and sort of what's going on underneath. And for me, somehow the crime is like, it's a much more obvious metaphor for the kind of the rot under the surface of everyday life and domestic life especially.
Hi, I was thinking about when people asked you why you write, I was reminded that somebody asked the poet Lorca that once, and he said, well, I write because I want people to like me. And I'm kind of wondering if people that liked you before like you differently now that you've created this marvelous book.
It's kind of a good thing, I think, but nothing has really changed. I think I had such a small group of friends before, so in many ways my life feels really exactly the same. Maybe people laugh at my jokes a little bit more, but I don't go out that much, so I don't get, you know, I'm doing okay, I think.
Which is pretty remarkable, given how life-changing this experience can be.
Yeah, I think I just really tried to remind myself it almost has nothing to do with me. It runs parallel to me and the book, but never really intersects with the reality of who I am and what's actually important to me. And that's been really nice to remember. And also equally that the good and the bad things are unreal in a
That's
in a
also
way.
Sort of crazy-ass mature for a 20. yeah.
One of my, well, many of my favorite scenes in this book involved food, because when we first meet the girls, they're dumpster diving, they're, you know, getting all this rancid stuff, and then they're going back to the commune, and they're, you know, trying to make a meal out of all this, you know, ragtag gross stuff. And then there were lots of scenes with food with Evie's mom, you know, when she, there's that really, I thought, very touching scene when she has the party and it's a disaster, but what she focuses on is the fact that her dessert failed. And so I was wondering if food, if there's something symbolic about food or if it says something about the characters as they enjoy it.
Yeah. I got a really funny email because, like, it was from a book club, and they're like, yeah, normally we make, like, a themed meal for our book club discussion. And they're like, your book? No. It's disgusting.
Blood sausage.
Yeah. I think for me it was really... Sorry. Thinking about, you know, day-to-day life in a commune situation and how could I suck some of the romance out of it? Because I was someone who totally romanticized communal living or, you know, these communes. Especially, I was thinking a lot of Olin Pali State Park in Nevada, which used to have a commune on it, I think called the Chosen Family. But, you know, you see these pictures and there's a real romance and nostalgia I can feel. For that moment, and then really trying to think, what would the days be like? What would the hygiene situation be like? What would the food actually be like? Really using food almost as a way to foreground the reality of these things, which could be romanticized. But no book club themed meals, unfortunately.
So you mentioned kind of about your prose, so kept underlining sentence after sentence in your book, and it was so beautifully written. And you mentioned you kind of focus on an image when you're writing. I'm just kind of curious, could you kind of go a bit more into that process? Because it's there's just so many like eloquent, really beautiful, beautiful sentences, and so I'm curious how you form those.
Yeah, I think it's partly thinking of like where does your brain immediately go when you are trying to communicate an image, and then thinking about what it is, what's next to it, what's off to the side, what's something maybe in the same family as the description you're trying to use, but not, you know, that first initial response. And then often, for me, it could be the way things sound, like a rhythm, which is funny. When I was in high school, I remember reading a Cormac McCarthy book, and I was very pretentious, just like circling everything. Oh, wow, so beautiful. And, you know, he uses such crazy words, and you're just like, ah. And he had this one line, and I underlined it, circled stars everywhere. Wow, wow, wow. And I, like, found this book later, you know, like a few years ago, and I was like, why did I underline this phrase? And I remember at the time, I was like, Silent Hills. Oh, that's beautiful. He's talking about silt. Like, oh, the black Silent Hills. And then I was like, silent. He just meant Silent Hills. And it was such like a horrible moment where my pretentious teenage self was exposed. And I feel like sometimes I'm still doing that where it's like something sounds so wonderful and then I have to actually, yeah. My editor a few times was like, there's no such word. But silent, I still think it's a good word, and I'm interested.
So even though your novel just uses the whole Manson history as a jumping off point, of course it is real and it is part of California history. And there are women in prison and Charles Manson. And curious, any reaction from them? Did they read the book? Have you heard from any of those folks?
Yeah, no. No contact, which is good, I think.
Yeah.
Probably.
I think, yeah. Sometimes at a signing maybe or something, someone will come with a manila envelope. And I see them from the table, and I'm like, ooh, someone's bringing me some goodies. And usually inside is like some crazy press clipping or something. So I don't know if anyone has it. A manila envelope.
Thanks to all of you so much for coming. Most of all, Emma Klein, Ellen Sussman, thank you so
thank
very
you so much.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Emma Klein, whose debut novel is The Girls. She was joined in conversation by writer and editor Ellen Sussman. On the next Bina, we'll feature food writer Mark Bittman as he talks about the art of baking and national food policy. Here's a little taste.
Margo started to ask a little bit ago about the food delivery services, because I'm interested in what you think about that, the price and the value and the portions.
Well, you know, I worked with one for a while, so, well, it's true. And I worked with Purple Carrot, which is the vegan meal delivery kit service. And I have to say that I haven't kept up with this since I left Purple Carrot, which was, say, 8 months ago. So I don't know what's going on. I believe that the prices are actually low, but I think the packaging is, let's say, a challenge. I was going to say a disgrace. But the packaging is a challenge, and in order to deal with the packaging, the price would need to go up. Shipping prices are not under control of the meal kit company, so that's a problem too. Labor costs are aligned with labor costs in the rest of the food industry, which is to say that workers are paid badly. So if you do spend more money on packaging and shipping is fixed and you pay workers better and you source ingredients better, which from my limited knowledge, sourcing is not done that responsibly. If you do all those things, the cost is going to go up by 50% or more. Then they would be priced fairly, and then people could make a reasonable decision about the convenience of them and maybe feel better about them or maybe feel good about them. But it's in a way, it's like asking me what I think about supermarkets. You can buy really good food in most supermarkets, but the cost is often artificially low. The workers are being treated badly. We often don't know where the food comes from, or as I said before, there's not a lot of transparency in the food industry. As those things change, food will become more expensive. This is why, I'm going to save someone a question here. This is why when you get to these kinds of questions, and it's a funny thing because it was an innocent enough question, but when you get to these kinds of questions about what food costs and valuing food at what it's actually worth or what the true costs are, and again, the true costs to the environment, the true costs to public health, the true costs to the workers who produce it, when you start factoring those in, food becomes more expensive. And I'm not talking about local or organic at this point. I'm talking about pricing food at its true cost. And then someone will inevitably say, in the old days, when people were less sophisticated, 2 years ago, someone would say, someone would inevitably say, what about people who can't afford to shop at Whole Foods? And I would inevitably say, I never used the word Whole Foods in this conversation. You brought that up, not me. But the question, the legitimate question is, what about people who can't afford to buy real food? And my answer to that is, and this is why food is such an important issue, is that that's not a food issue. That is a social justice issue. So now we're talking about social justice. I'm happy to talk about social justice as long as you want, but what we're talking about now is income inequality. We're talking about discussion of guaranteed basic income. We're talking about how to make it so that the less well-off people in this country, and something like 50 million people in this country, are at least occasionally food insecure, can not only not be food insecure, because our definition of food insecure is they can't afford to buy Kraft dinner, as we call it in Canada. They can't afford to buy Kraft macaroni and cheese. That's kind of a definition of food insecure. If your definition of food insecure was people who can't afford to buy real good ingredients, it would be 100 million people probably. How do we fix that? It's not a food question. Just like how do we make sure that everybody has a decent place to live is not actually a housing question. It's a social justice question. So forgive me if you had no interest in hearing any of that. But
that was a preview of next week's Bina, featuring food writer Mark Bittman. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelet. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.